Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you all. This is the least St. Patrick's, least festive program you're going to hear in the history of this podcast, because this, of course, is the week that Stephen Hawking passed.
I am very aware of the preciousness of time. Seize the moment. Act now. I have spent my life traveling across the universe, inside my mind. Through theoretical physics, I have sought to answer some of the great questions. But there are other challenges, other big questions which must be answered, and these will also need a new generation who are interested, engaged, and with an understanding of science. How will we feed an ever-growing population? Provide clean water, generate renewable energy, prevent and cure disease, and slow down global climate change. I hope that science and technology will provide the answers to these questions, but it will take people, human beings with knowledge and understanding, to implement these solutions. But it would be an empty universe indeed, if it were not for the people I love, and who love me. We are all time travelers, journeying together into the future. But let us work together to make that future a place we want to visit. Be brave, be determined, overcome the odds. It can be done.
We're going to be talking about the man himself, both as a scientist and as a celebrity and a science communicator. We're going to talk about his contributions to the Big Bang Theory and Hawking radiation. And we're also going to talk to Marcelo Glazer about some of the barriers that Stephen Hawking was trying to break down, the barriers to our knowledge. We're going to talk about the things that we will never know, no matter how hard we try with science. If you'd like to email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. As always, though, we'll look back at the week's science news, and joining me in studio is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Dungan. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Don't feel bad, Lisa. Sometimes the smartest of us can be the most childish.
Even you?
No, not me. Never.
You know, actually, I was looking at some of the tributes to Stephen Hawking, and someone on Twitter put it quite well. You know, they were saying the universe has another star tonight, and blah, blah, blah. And it sounds like that we've literally fired Stephen Hawking into space. But this man was a prankster. He was, a scientist. He was a celebrity, an extraordinary man. And also, we might point out, someone who did not want to be remembered for his time on The Simpsons.
Yeah, now you've just played The Simpsons.
Yeah, well, we are going to talk about the science, but talk to us a little bit about Hawking the man.
He was an incredible human being, and I mean that in the broadest sense. He was really childlike in his comment to Lisa. Like, I suppose he's lying there. Because he saw the universe through the eyes of a child in a wonderful way. I know that sounds very cliched often when we talk about scientists, but he actually did have that passion, that curiosity, and that was always at the key for his public interactions. And he put public interactions, public engagement, at the very center of his scientific being.
Almost to the point of being a showman.
Yeah, well, I think he was entertaining for sure, yeah. But he understood the importance of scientists talking about the human condition, scientists talking about society, and the scientific perspective. He never actually came across as like the scientist's view is always right, but he said that it is a view, and it's a view worth having in society. And he often said that it was missing in certain debates. So things like the rational debates, things like Brexit, the health system in the UK, the rise of artificial intelligence, climate change, the election of nationalists like Donald Trump and other people like that. He had opinions on all of these things, and he wasn't afraid to talk about them.
And the breakup of One Direction.
That's actually true, yeah. So it's true. When teenage girls and boys were very disappointed at the breakup of One Direction, he said in the...
Not just teenagers.
Okay, Jonathan, in the alternative universes out there, there may well be One Direction still together. So yeah, he had that funny side, right, which was wonderful. He had... he had really, as I said, a really human approach. And so that sense of connecting with society is something that set him apart. And he was really brave in doing that. He says, I listened to the Desert Island Discs about him this week, actually, after he died. It's really worthwhile listening to. And he talks about him being a procrastinator in his study days and having this life-changing event in his early 20s when he was diagnosed with motor neuron disease and having to decide then to make something of his life. And with the short window that he was given, he grabbed life with both hands and he dove straight into his PhD work. He was very fortunate that his disease didn't take him until his 76th year, but he retained that passion for life right through his career and his personal life.
He was also controversial. I mean, most scientists that, you know, I try to needle on this subject kind of say, well, we don't really know, but he very much said there is no God. And I think weighing in on that as someone who is revered as one of the smartest men on the planet at the time, that's a pretty
he said, we are all free to believe what we wish, but he believed that there was no God, and he said he believed it for rational reasons.
I think he said it a little bit stronger than that, for someone to come out and say that in the public sphere, that is it's a provocative thing to do.
It is, but for many people, that's true. For many people, there is no God. So he was reflecting a perspective that many, perhaps a lot more scientists would hold than would be willing to say. Well, he said these things. This is what made him different. And a lot of other scientists didn't like the fact that he came out and said things. And he suffered from something called the Carl Sagan effect, which is scientists who speak publicly are often ridiculed by other scientists because they're saying you're going beyond the realm of science, which I think is a very narrow view of science, right? Of course, he's expert at black holes and things like that, and his expertise falls off as he moves away from it, but yet he is seen as a very sort of a public intellectual, right? So his perspective is valid.
He also, I believe, held a party for time travellers, which I think is such a genius idea.
Yeah,
to see if anyone shows up.
And he sent the invitation after the event, so like he said now the only flaw there is that maybe in the future people might have invented a machine and not be aware of his invitation, right? So
can I ask a Stephen Hawking question? You know, the voice, did he have that originally because he needed it from a long time ago and he could have had a more modernized?
It was the only voice that was available at the time, or at least one of very few because of the technology. And actually, he had been many times approached by organizations who can now do a much more realistic sounding voice, of course. But he said, this is my voice.
That's his
voice. It feels weird to try and change that. And that's why he stuck with that voice. And I think it certainly...
It's iconic.
Absolutely.
If you hear that voice, you don't think of a computer. You think of Stephen Hawking.
Yeah.
Our second story, Lara, is to do with space. It's a nice segue. And a remarkable sort of fact that if you put a twin in space for a year, they will change so much that they will sort of no longer be a twin.
So, yeah, in January, NASA released a statement about Mark and Scott Kelly. These twin brothers, identical twin brothers, were both astronauts. And both had been to the ISS, but... Scott, at the age of 54, went for 340 days, essentially for a year. And they did this thing called the twin study. They assessed his DNA beforehand, they assessed it in the middle, and then they assessed it again afterwards. And they released a particularly ambiguous press release in January of this year, which stated that he had changed his genes by 7% when he came back down.
And now, even 7%, like if we look at, you know, the often quoted figure for chimpanzees is like 96 and 98,
yeah,
right? So that's a lot.
So both the astronauts themselves also picked up on this and were tweeting saying we're no longer identical twins. But the fact is that a chimpanzee is only 96% is 96% similar to us, and even a cat is 90% the same as us. A banana is 60% the same as us. So what this press release taken at face value would suggest is he came back somewhere in between a cat and a chimp hybrid. So what they released and what the papers picked up was completely incorrect.
Oh.
So he did not change his DNA pretty much at all, actually. So what happened was, in any stressful situation, our body changes the genes that it produces, so the proteins it produces. So if we went to the top of a high mountain, if we got really sick, or we went into space, our bodies are under onslaught and we produce different proteins. So what happened was his body produced loads of different proteins, and when he came back to Earth, 7% of those proteins didn't go back to the way they'd been. That is the very small, but still really interesting fact.
He was also younger.
He's older. So his telomeres lengthened in space, but then they went back to normal within 2 days of arriving back. So his telomeres are the little bits that keep his DNA kind of structurally sound at either end and stop it unraveling and stop it aging. So he did get younger in space, but when he came back, they went back to normal. And actually, there's evidence that he's now older than his brother.
But time passed slower for him in space than his twin on Earth.
Physics, yeah. Come on. You know, Stephen Hawking said that if he had been born much later, he would have gone into biology instead of physics.
And you know why he didn't go into biology?
I don't.
He said it wasn't rational.
Oh, get out of it. But yeah, so he's not 7% different. He's not a chimp cat hybrid. He's still human. He's still his twin's brother, but he's just producing slightly different proteins.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of struggle with the whole we're similar in, you know, we're 96% similar in DNA to a chimpanzee. I don't get how
it's all junk DNA, most of it anyway. Like, you and I are 99.9% identical in DNA. Like, all three of us in this room are. So you can't change by 7%. Your DNA cannot change by 7%.
It did seem kind of strange.
It's completely impossible.
And grapes have
yes, grapes.
Yes, grapes, obviously.
Grapes have 30,000 genes, right? I learned this today. Grapes have 30,000 genes and chickens have 16,000 genes. Mm. And so genetically, if you want to measure it that way, we are somewhere in between the chicken and a grape.
Yes, we are a nice chicken-grape hybrid.
Yeah. Shane, we're building a Death Star.
Yeah, we are. So from the sublime of Hawkins to the ridiculous now with NASA, they are building a giant Death Star to send up into space that could pulverize an incoming asteroid.
The analogies between Trump and Darth Vader continue.
Yeah, I just imagine there's somebody in NASA who's saying to themselves, you know, he's not so keen on the whole climate change thing. So what can we give him that he's really going to want?
And it's like a big red button.
A big red button with a bomb at the end of it, right? And so they're calculating basically how much nuclear power they would need in order to explode a massive asteroid. This would be an asteroid that would wipe out life on Earth.
So how prepared are we? So at the moment, if an asteroid comes, how much notice do we have? Because these things travel pretty fast, right?
Could we
find out tomorrow that an asteroid is coming in a week that will kill us?
Well, there are asteroids that pass by us all the time. In fact, there are many that hit us all the time. It's just how big they are, right? So what you're talking about is something catastrophic.
Yeah, so, dinosaur type thing.
So there are many that go nearby. I guess what would happen is we'd know they're coming close, but it's only when they get pretty close that we can figure out how close they are. So that sounds pretty confusing.
stupid science.
You're so
answer.
Science right
no,
now.
What I'm saying is, if I'm here right now, right, could I open the paper tomorrow and scientists go, well, we just didn't see that coming. Oh. You've got a week to live.
Yes. Good question.
Is that genuinely a thing?
Yes.
Okay, so we do need to create a Death Star.
But it's not probable. The probability of us killing ourselves from many, many other things is much higher.
You're getting all social on it.
No, this is like saying you could choke on a grape in a car, so it's more important to put anti-grape devices in a car than a seatbelt.
All right, when you put it like that, that's
what
a pretty
good argument.
What about
a chicken? Can you choke on the chicken as well?
Yeah, so, but hang on.
I'd like to see that.
But I guess what I wanted to know is, are we monitoring for these big things that and do we know how close they are? Okay, so we basically, something could happen soon, but we don't know.
Yes.
Although we are due, mathematically, probabilistically, within the next million years.
Say that again.
Mathematically, probabilistically. We are due one.
Oh,
and if we are due one, that so far, as far as I know, the plans that we have are A, heat it up.
Yeah.
Or B, paint it.
Yes, that's right. Paint one side of it black.
Yeah. And that would just, that might, like, how you get to this asteroid before it kills it.
NASA is sending missions to asteroids at the moment to try and dig into them and see what matter is in there, and we could understand.
Okay, but that seems like a very, blowing it up seems like a pretty good idea to me. How are they going to blow it up with the Death Star?
With a giant nuclear bomb.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That sounds
you
awesome.
See, when I re- no, it doesn't.
It does.
When I read this, right, I was like, I wonder what they're really trying to do in this story about maybe like putting it out there to certain other countries that are a bit aggressive at the moment, that we can make bigger bombs than you can.
Oh, God.
Oh, it's a space race thing, you think?
Yeah.
I don't know, you're such
definitely.
A cynic.
Just send a laser toward it and move it a little bit. It's far more like...
Very quickly, Lara, relationships make you more... chunky.
Yeah, there's a study from Queensland University. It took 15,000 people, self-reported, and if you're in a couple, you smoke less, you drink less, you actually eat less fast food, you eat more fruit and veg, but you are still fatter. And they say it's probably because you have more group family meals, probably because you don't make, or you don't need to look so good anymore because you're already in a couple.
What?
And also, I know, and also they think it's because when you have children, you eat all their food. And this actually is work. I have a niece and nephew and I eat everything that they won't eat. And that definitely would make you fatter. So yeah, if you're in a couple, you're going to get fatter, guys.
Worthy of Stephen Hawking, that paper,
I'll
isn't
tell
it?
You what.
No, but that makes complete sense to me. And also, it's received wisdom from our parents, you know, not letting food go to waste. And you just like keep cramming this stuff. And by the time, like then, because often you have to, as a parent, you know, you give their kids the food first because otherwise all hell breaks loose. So you have to prepare their food first and then you eat after yours is cold and you're thrown into it. And then you get all their scraps. It's
but that's a correlation between having children and being obese, not being in a relationship.
Why do we have you on this show?
Because I don't know. I bring a rationality.
This is really. Oh, you are literally the party pooper. I bet you weren't invited to Stephen Hawking's time travel party. Simon in D3 says there's a problem with this. I read this week that Professor Hawking had a time travel themed party where he sent the invites out a week after the actual event. If time travel were proved to be possible, the guests should have arrived anyway.
That's the whole point of the party.
Yeah.
Simon in D3.
No, but like, why bother sending out the invites? Because they were already there.
Well, you have to send them so that in the future they get their invite and then they know to come back to the party.
Yeah.
I'm even with Shane on this one. I very rarely agree with Shane, but I'm sorry, Simon. You're wrong. But, I think.
But oh, man.
Read his book, A Brief History of Time. It did change my perspective on science when I was 18.
Dr. Shane Berger from UCD and Dr. Laura Duggan.
Snow leopard enthusiast.
Snow leopard enthusiast. Thank you both very much. On the way, Dr. John Regan on the Big Bang, Hawking radiation and meeting the late, great man himself.
Of years, mankind lived just like the animals. Then something happened which unleashed the power of our imagination. We learned to talk.
Typical Pink Floyd, isn't it? Like they decided to quote, you know, possibly one of the smartest men on the planet at the time, but like, well, they wouldn't give enough volume to actually hear what he was saying. He's like, no, screw this, here's some guitar. surreal as it was, that was Stephen Hawking appearing in the Pink Floyd song Keep Talking in 1994. Hawking had long since become a well-known public figure and popularizer of science, but perhaps in achieving that fame, his academic achievements being somewhat obscured. And he famously said, I hope I'm remembered for my work in science and questioning the beginnings of our universe and not for appearing on The Simpsons. So let's talk about his science. What did Hawking do that was so revolutionary? Dr. John Regan from the Centre of Astrophysics and Relativity in DCU joins us now. John, this is your
bread and butter.
Your bread and butter, and it must be a sad week for you because you met the man, and when you were studying this stuff, he was sitting in lectures beside you.
Yeah, that's right. So when I was we were at very different levels. When I was in Cambridge, I was a graduate student, and Stephen was location. Professor of mathematics, a post previously held by Isaac Newton, so not to be sniffed at. So yeah, so he was in the Department of Advanced Mathematics and Theoretical Physics, and there was a cosmology seminar every Thursday at lunchtime. So you'd bring your lunch along and somebody would give a seminar. And so more often than not now, in fairness, Stephen was not there. But on occasion he was rolled in. And, for a graduate student, this was tremendously exciting, I have to say. It was so cool. You were just in the room with Stephen Hawking and in a science environment. Might be 10 people there. So it wasn't like it was 300. It was, really small numbers. And it was really, really interesting. His motor neuron disease was very debilitating. He wasn't able to converse in any of these talks. And I remember the first one I was at, or maybe even the second one as well. You'd be sitting and listening to the talk and that was fine. And next thing you hear this, maybe, or no, and you'd be like, oh, as a student, you just kind of like turn around and be like, should we stop the talk? Is everything okay here?
Yeah.
But that was just the way he communicated in those environments. It was, one single word. It was just a yes, a no, or a maybe. And that's, that was the limitations of his illness. And it was unfortunate for sure. Yeah.
It's amazing, though, that limitation, of course, didn't stop him from, in many ways, changing how the public views this issue and how the public views science and appreciates the universe. So let's talk about his science and his work on the Big Bang, because up until then, the Big Bang idea, it wasn't new, but it was sort of up in the air.
It definitely wasn't mainstream. When Hawking started in Cambridge, he initially wanted his supervisor to be Fred Hoyle. And Fred Hoyle didn't believe in the Big Bang. That was not his meat at all. He was steady state cosmology, which just meant that the universe was quite eternal and not really changing at all, a steady state model, and that matter just formed out of nothingness, and that's how the universe maybe expanded. And so the Big Bang one was not mainstream at all.
So at that stage, it was observed that the universe was expanding?
Yeah, sorry, I should clarify. The universe, they did know the universe was expanding, but they didn't know it was accelerated expansion. But yeah, you're right. Hoyle was more the steady state one. And the Big Bang one was becoming mainstream. And Hawking really kind of like charged that momentum as well. And he gave it, he used a singularity theorem from Roger Penrose, who proved it in the context of black holes only, and he applied it to the entire universe. So he took the universe and said, like, well, what happens if we apply this singularity and we say that the universe collapses back to a singularity? And he was able to prove that in the context of general relativity.
Okay, so what is a singularity?
That's a very good question. So I don't know if anybody really knows what a singularity is, but it is a point of infinite density and pressure. So it is literally a one divided by a zero. It's where our mathematical theories break down. And generally, if you come across a singularity, you have done something horribly wrong. But nonetheless, every theory that we use, especially general relativity, tends to end in a singularity when the scales get very, very tiny.
Now, so some sort of event beyond which it's impossible to perceive or measure.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is presumably then the beginning of the universe. Beyond that is a singularity.
Yeah, for a lot of people, maybe the simplest thing is to think of the universe beginning as a singularity. Now, that has real problems, of course, as well, because then you ask, well, where did the singularity come from?
Yeah.
So there's no good answer to any of that. Really what happens is general relativity is a large scale theory and it breaks down. It's not the theory we should use at these small scales. So the fact that general relativity is giving us a singularity is just simply telling us that we're using the wrong theory at those scales and that we should be looking at more of a quantum theory. We have not been able to marry those two theories. General relativity does not fit into quantum mechanics, and that's why we get singularities.
And that's what Hawking's work sort of helped towards, right? He was trying to fix these two set of rules that didn't really make sense.
Yeah, you've given me an excellent segue there. So I think in 1,000 years' time, I don't think, don't take offense here, anybody will remember News Talk. But I think that people will remember Stephen Hawking because of Hawking radiation. So he was able to marry quantum mechanics and general relativity on the outside of a black hole. So, and he had called this Hawking radiation. So just outside the horizon of a black
hole.
Modest
of him.
Yeah, indeed. Just outside the horizon of a black hole, the curvature is not so bad. So general relativity is in what we call a weak field limit. So we can marry it at that level with quantum mechanics. And that's exactly what Hawking did. And he showed that this black holes always radiate. They have a Hawking temperature, so they're hot, and they radiate particles.
So the reason why this is important is because up until this point, people didn't know what happened in the middle of a black hole. And it was sort of like putting your hand through a portal, right? We could not see what happened to the matter or energy. It disappeared. And the most important part is that that's not supposed to happen in the world. You can't just disappear energy or matter, right? And so he was trying to figure out, where did this energy go? And so this sort of fizzing or popping that happens around the outside of the black hole that causes radiation to do with particles appearing and disappearing at the same time. Is that right?
Yeah, very good. Exactly. So Hawking actually used that. That's exactly what happens. So in the quantum world, we have particles that kind of like zip in and out. We call them virtual particles. And they're created exactly from energy. And so Hawking was able to prove that if that happened right on the boundary of a black hole, one of them would actually zip off away from the horizon, but one would get sucked back in just because they were separated by this tiny little wavelength or distance. And he called that Hawking radiation. So theoretically, that's right. Rock solid sound. Now, we don't have any empirical evidence for that because that's a very difficult problem, unfortunately.
Study something like that.
No.
What makes it so hard to study? I mean, obviously black holes are difficult because they suck light and energy and so they're difficult to observe. But can we not see what's happening around the rim of a black hole?
Oh, absolutely. We definitely can. The only problem is that the Hawking radiation is, you know, way, 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 way subdominant to anything else that's happening around there. So it's much far more minor contribution than the matter that's falling in. So the matter falls in and emits energy, as it, and light as it's falling in, as it's spiraling in. But that is orders of magnitude, like tens, hundreds, billions of times larger than the Hawking radiation.
What else did Hawking can contribute to astrophysics?
I think the other big contribution to black hole physics in particular was he kind of linked thermodynamics with black hole mechanics. So he was able to link these laws of thermodynamics, which tell us about temperature and entropy, which is a measure of disorder. So this desk I look around here is quite disordered. So it's got like a high... And it's got a high level of entropy.
Right.
So unfortunately, if somebody were to come in and clean this, the entropy would go up even further. Because it's you'd have to use more energy to clean the desk, which would give you more entropy. So it's when your mother tells you to clean the room, just tell her you don't want to increase the entropy.
Right.
But anyways, what Hawking did was, so people worried about matter falling into a black hole and that might destroy entropy. Entropy can never be destroyed. So that's like a fundamental rule of thermodynamics. It's one that we cannot break. We must always move to more entropy in the universe. It must always we must always give it energy. And energy then requires entropy, and entropy then just keeps on growing. So we can at most have a constant level of entropy, but at least. And then like we will always get more and more entropy.
But how is that possible?
And the universe is just going in that direction. So a lot of people link entropy to time, for example.
Right.
And that if we started in a very low entropy universe, that might explain why time started then. But it'll always then keep going. And that's why Sean Carroll is a brilliant theoretical physicist at Caltech. And he strongly advocates the idea that the arrow of time is basically linked to entropy. And that's why time flows in this direction.
So the universe is becoming more disordered,
and
systems are becoming more disordered. But that makes it sound like energy is, because surely if it's coming from one place, does the place it's coming from not become more ordered?
It doesn't work like that. Yeah. No, it doesn't work like that.
Do you know what? I've had those sort of questions with astrophysicists, and they always go, okay, this is just an analogy, and now you're not smart enough to be able to get it. So that's fine.
But now, if we go back to the early universe, we should see a lower entropy state, and it should start to, and that's why we see it increasing.
Okay, no, and that is totally fine, because, you know, you have spent your entire year devoted to this, your entire life devoted to this sort of a question, and I'm spending 15 minutes in a radio studio.
But also, like, Hawking as well worried about this problem, and so... when we don't destroy matter as it goes into the black hole, or the entropy doesn't decrease, the actual black hole grows in mass, and we relate the entropy to the area of the black hole. So the entropy always increases.
So the work of people like Hawking and other people like Sean Carroll, Brian Greene, what they're trying to do, right, is they're trying to link up the sort of mathematics from the tiny scale to the large scale, so that we have a sort of a clearer picture of how the universe all figures itself out. And that's what Hawking was trying to do. He was trying to link these two things together. Do you think his work will stand the test of time?
I think that definitely the Hawking radiation work will, even if that ultimately proves to be incorrect. And Hawking was incorrect in a lot of the work he did. And people, you know, that is not a bad thing. Not a bad thing at all, because often he came up with incredible lateral ideas and people were like, oh, that didn't work. But he was very close, and, you know, they shifted it a tiny bit and made something work. So he was very good at pushing physics in new directions.
Right.
So Hawking will be remembered for that for the stuff that didn't work as much as the stuff that did work. Hawking radiation, theoretically very sound, may prove that we can never see it and prove that, okay, it doesn't exist. But he'll have brought us in new directions, marrying quantum mechanics and general relativity, no doubt about it.
Few questions that have been on my mind since reading about Stephen Hawking. Black hole, flat or a circle?
Sphere.
It's a sphere.
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to ask you, can you have, how big do they go? Like, and would you be able to go through one without being destroyed? Do we know?
So they, as big as they go, what happens there is that they can, so as they're growing, they consume matter, obviously, because that then goes into the black hole and makes the black hole larger. And as that matter is spiraling, it gives off more and more radiation. So there's kind of a limit there, about a billion solar masses, because then the radiation that's falling in gets so intense that nothing else can fall in. And
it reaches a sort of a...
Yeah, there's almost a saturation point in terms of the feedback, essentially.
Okay.
And so that's about as big as they get. And we don't see any bigger than that either.
Final stupid black hole question. I thought when I was listening about that, I was thinking, wouldn't it be amazing to get a recorder and on a satellite and send it into a black hole? And then I thought, That would be a pointless thing to do because we wouldn't be able to get anything back from it. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely correct. No, but you've touched on something that's very important there, actually. So people worry about these singularities and that like that's somehow breaking, you know, the universe. But one of the ways we can get around that is, well, like, okay, let's say the universe breaks inside a black hole. It can never communicate that brokenness with the outside universe. So these things are almost separate. Because light can never get out, nothing gets out. So that is one of the tricks that physicists use. Because we don't understand the inside of a black hole, you're like, okay, it doesn't matter, we don't understand. It is literally a black box, and we just go like, okay, it's nonsense, crazy stuff in there, but it doesn't affect the outside world.
It's crazy yeah. stuff in there. Yeah. It's like the office of Mad Magazine.
Indeed.
Finally, what did Hawking say about the boundaries of our universe?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So he worked on a model with Jim Hartle, also from the University of California. And what he wanted to look at there is like almost like very similar to what we've been discussing. He's like, okay, let's go back to the start of the universe. And again, this singularity, how do we get around that? So he talked about having no boundary at the start, and that it is in some ways meaningless to talk about a single starting point.
That's a bit of a cop out, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. No, I agree with you totally. Like,
Your hunch on where it all came from?
Oh God, that's very hard. I think the thing is, at the moment, we don't have a good theory. So you go back to that very starting point and we're just asking the wrong questions. Like, so basically, it's like if you go back to the analogy with the Earth being flat and people are like, no, the Earth is flat. Why would it be round? That makes no sense at all. And like, I think in some ways we're at that point as well. We're probably asking the wrong question. We're probably thinking the universe is for want of a better word, flat. But when it's actually round, so it's very hard to get out of that context.
Right.
So we're using the wrong theory to explore that early stage of the universe, but we don't know what the right theory is. We're desperately looking for it, and we will, I hope, find it. We'll need a new Stephen Hawking. We need a new Albert Einstein for sure. They'll get us there, though. Just time.
But did he think the universe had a limit, or did he think the universe went on forever?
No, he definitely thought it had a limit. What he actually speculated was that time and space separated, so the time became meaningless at that starting point, that you couldn't look backwards, and that he'd used this thing called a Wick rotation. So he made time imaginary, so that is a mathematical trick, if you like. But he is separating out, so he thinks there's a space there, or he thought there was a space there, and then he's like, time kind of comes from nothing a little bit, you know, and like that's not a very good answer. Like, and that's like,
but that's what happens, yeah. Until we find a better model, we end up with these singularities like black holes, and where did time come from? Where did the universe come from?
It's an outstanding problem in theoretical physics. This is what we're trying to find out. He's Hawking, so people listen to it.
Right.
Definitely. Is it the right model? Almost certainly not. But hopefully, it'll lead us in direction. I think that's one of the things Hawking should definitely remember for. He was an inspiration, a leader. He took us in new directions, and that's maybe his greatest legacy will be.
Absolutely, and I think the world of science and the world at large has lost a great man. Unfortunately, time in this studio is very real, and we are out of it. Dr. John Regan, Centre of Relative Physics and Relativity in DCU, thanks very much for coming.
Thank you.
Actually, that interview with John perfectly leads us into the next piece after the break, where we're going to be speaking to Marcelo Gleiser about the limits of our knowledge and whether or not there are things we can never possibly know. You can text us for 30¢, 53106. You can also email us, science@newstalk.com. Now, since forever, we've wondered about our place in the universe and tried to figure out how everything around us fits together. But as someone put it quite well just now, John Regan, at some point we reach these sort of singularities where our understanding breaks down. And there are some questions that science may never answer. So why do we persist with it? Well, Marcelo Gleiser is Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Dartmouth and the author of The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. Welcome to the programme, Marcelo. And I suppose the week that's in it, I thought it would be a great opportunity to talk to you about where science breaks down. Welcome to the programme. Talk to us a little bit about the limitations that we see in science, because there are many of them, aren't there?
Yes, well, thank you. Thanks for having me. And yes, there are many, and that's a good thing, let's put it that way, because we don't want to have all the answers, because if we did, we'd have to go retire. You know, we want to make sure that science always have stuff to worry about and to wonder about. And you know, and you can pick your topic in the sciences. Of course, I come from a physics background and also astrobiology that studies the origin of life on Earth and the possibility of life in the universe. And let's pick physics just to start. And for example, we cannot know what's beyond what we can see of the universe. You know, one, we have a narrative of the history of the universe now, which is the Big Bang model,
yeah,
right? And the Big Bang model tells us that everything started 13.8 billion years ago. And you know that the way we collect information from faraway places like stars and galaxies is through the light and other kinds of radiation they emit, like radio waves, ultraviolet waves. Those waves always travel at the speed of light, right? So 300,000 kilometers per second, which is a ridiculously fast speed. Now, that tells you that if information has a very fast but finite speed, it means that there are things beyond what we can receive. And that's what's called a cosmic horizon. It's kind of like when you go to the beach and you look out and you see a point where the ocean and the sky connect one another, the horizon, and you know there is more ocean beyond there, but you cannot see it. So with our view of the universe is the same way. So we have what's called an information, a cosmic horizon, which is as far as we can see of the universe. So you cannot know ever, unless you violate the speed of light, which we don't think we can, we cannot know ever what's going on outside. So that's an unanswerable question according to our current views of physics.
Well, I mean, I read about physics and scientists, and on this program several times I've talked about how people are trying to understand how the universe began, but that's bullshit, really, isn't it? I mean, it's all rubbish, because we can never go back. So why bother studying 2 seconds after the Big Bang? Why bother studying the point at which the Big Bang started? Because we can never, ever possibly know. It's an extraordinarily unsatisfying and if you were being really cynical about it, pointless thing to do.
Right. I wouldn't call it bullshit because, you know, let's think about this a second. Let's build an analogy between what cosmologists are doing and what paleontologists do, right? So they go out and they dig those very old bones from dinosaurs, and they're able to reconstruct a whole history of Earth 100 million years ago based on that evidence.
With limited success, I might say, but go on.
With limited success, but you know, we do know about T-Rex, and we do know about a bunch of other guys, yeah, and weird creatures that lived a long time ago because of this effort. So cosmology, in a sense, is doing very similar things. We're trying to collect clues from very far away so that we can reconstruct the history of the universe from as close to the beginning as possible. Okay, so that's the caveat there, right? What does that mean? Well, right now, we are very confident that we understand the history of the universe from at least 1 second, even 1/100 of a second, from the Big Bang to nowadays. Now, there are details we miss, but we kind of have the big picture. So the question is, how far back, closer to the beginning of time, can you push this? And that's where the difficulties begin. For certain, at the very, very beginning of time, what we call T equals zero.
But to me, it's like interviewing Richard Gere and not asking about the hamster. Like the question that everybody wants to know the answer to, we will never solve. So what, right, you know? So I guess everything else is just filling in pieces, but the main, you know, the bit that shows you what the picture is made of, we don't get. We can't possibly know that. In the same way as we can't know when we look at tiny particles in the Hadron Collider, we can't possibly know what's beyond our ability to measure.
Right.
But the question is, where do we all come from? That's the question. And we okay, can't ever answer that.
Well, depends on the context of what you mean by coming from, right? I mean, we do know a lot about the evolution of life on Earth, So we do know where we came from in terms of evolving from primates, and we have a common ancestor that is the common ancestor of every living creature right now. So we can reconstruct the history of life on this planet very well. We also know, and that's a very beautiful thing, that all the chemical elements that are part of your body are remains of stars that died billions and billions of years ago, much before our sun was born. So we do have this very beautiful notion that we understand where the stuff that we are made of come from. But so you can say that is a tremendous triumph of modern science. But what you're trying to get to, if I understand you well, and sort of this frustration you're coming from, it's a frustration that tells you, can science ever answer the question of the origin of the universe itself? Which is, you know, of course, a subject that is really has been forever a subject of religion, right? I mean, many different religions across the world have a creation myth, right? A story of how the world came to be. And the question is, can science play that role? And let me say that even now that Stephen Hawking, given that he just passed away, he and a bunch of other people have constructed mathematical models of how the universe could come into being, so to speak, right? And he himself and others, I think, erroneously proclaimed that that was enough, that we understand the problem, that God is dead, etc., etc., etc. And I have to say that any one of these models, first of all, has not been tested, so we have no idea if they're true or false. And second of all, they depend on a series of assumptions that we need in order to build any kind of scientific model, right? So in case of physics, you need laws of nature. You need like the conservation of energy. You need to use general relativity, which is a theory that explains gravity. You need to use quantum physics. So the question becomes, okay, you put these ingredients together and you come up with a model that tells you about the bang. But the question is, where do these theories come from? Right? And you end up with this.
Yeah, it's a turtle on the back of a turtle. I don't know where that actual reference came from, but I always seem to use it. It makes no sense to me. But it's, you know, that this sort of Russian doll scenario.
Exactly.
And I guess the part of the frustration is that as someone who doesn't believe in God living in a country where it affects so much, even imperceptibly, no matter how we have moved on, there are still things that happen that are sort of directed by this commonly accepted way of life that is informed by a belief in a God. And because we can't measure the beginning of the universe, because we can't, you know, say definitively anything, you have to admit that, you're absolutely right. I don't know, but the evidence is not very strong for a God if you look at it. But at the same time, I don't know. And I suppose that is sort of frustrating to me, because it's always the thing that comes back at you, sort of like, well, I don't know.
Yeah, and that's the point, is that we are reaching a moment, and I think myself and some other scientists and philosophers we have to learn to live and accept ignorance. You know, you have to kind of have the humility to understand that there are some questions which are just not very well posed scientific questions, and that's okay. You know, science gives us a lot of other stuff. For example, the ability for me to be here in northern New England talking to you in Ireland in St. Patrick's Day, by the way. And that's just a wonderful thing, but it does not need to fulfill this existential role of giving us certain kinds of answers that are really more metaphysical and more into the spiritual realm. That's not what science is about.
I suppose that is a common misconception, isn't it, that science is there to sort of dispel religion. But no matter how much you push the frontiers of our understanding, the other side is always going to be filled by religion and philosophy. Do you believe in God?
I do not. I am an agnostic. So you kind of got to that position. You said there is no evidence. And so my position is very simple, and which is, you know, I don't see any evidence for it. I don't see any need for it. But I'm not going to decree that God doesn't exist, because that would be a completely anti-scientific approach. You cannot decree that something doesn't exist if you do not have evidence either way. So I just keep an open mind, and I have tremendous respect for people of different faiths. You know, I think that we are very complex creatures. We have very many dimensions of existence. You know, one is pragmatic, the other one is more metaphysical, and we need different kinds of answers for the same question sometimes, right?
Just to finish up, because I wanted to ask you if you think we will ever reach the end of what humans can know. You know, we were talking about these sort of singularities that John Regan talked about. Do you think we'll ever come up to a wall where we could say no amount of thinking or working will do that when it comes to biology, for example, or things outside of the universe?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And of course, nobody really knows the answer. But my hopeful answer to that is that no, is that as long as we have funding to keep asking questions and doing research, I don't see how that's possible. Because very briefly, if you look at the history of science, okay, what you find is something really cool. You'll find that as you make progress, say, for example, astronomy before and after the telescope, or biology before and after the microscope, as you make progress and you create new tools, new questions open up that you couldn't even have predicted before. Mm. This is where this metaphor of the island of knowledge comes from. You know, the island grows as you learn more, but so do the shores of our ignorance, which is sort of the boundary between what we know and what we don't know.
And so depending on the sort of person you are, that is either a wondrous delight, or it is a depressing way to be and to know that you will never, ever, ever make any headway. It's been fantastic speaking with you. Marcelo Gleiser, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Dartmouth College. Bob has texted in saying, Socrates said, "The only thing I do know is that I know nothing." Well said, Bob. Wonderfully deep and heavy stuff for St. Patrick's Day. I love it if you actually have come home and downloaded the podcast after going out and celebrating St. Patrick's Day. Let us know what you made of Marcelo's ideas there, because, you know, I think it's that beautiful intersection between philosophy and science that is so interesting to me. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. Some of your texts and emails from last week. We were talking about new therapies to restore sight in mice, and a recent study that allowed sort of gold nanoparticles to basically counteract the problems that people have when they get age-related macular degeneration. Someone said, what about the poor mice and the pain and distress they are subjected to? It is a problem that we don't address all the time, because if you were to kind of address that issue every single time we talked about science in this program, unfortunately, we'd probably have a long and lengthy conversation about animal welfare every single week. The reality is that in science today, a lot of mice, rats, all sorts of animals are used as analogs. Thanks, Jen. As analogs for human beings. They're not great models. They aren't brilliant. Some people would say that we should be striving harder to make more efforts to create replicas of the human system in the brain. That is not where we are at the moment. And so that's sort of where we are. And I you know, you basically either believe that inflicting pain on an animal, as little pain as possible, but, you know, let's be clear, if we're talking about pain research, you're inflicting pain on animals. In this case, you're making them blind. You need to decide whether or not you think that is worth the potential gain. And if you look at the gain and benefits of science, you have to think, do I think all of the medicine that has come to us so far, or a large part of it, is worth what we do? And I have to say, some days I think it is, and some days I think it isn't. We also were talking about voodoo dolls and how research shows, inverted commas research shows, that if you have a voodoo doll of an annoying boss, you can be up to a third less pissed off with them by using a voodoo doll and sticking needles in them. One says, I have a voodoo doll of my principal. I stick pins in her all the time, from an anonymous primary school teacher. What if someone found that in your drawer? That's just really, really creepy. You know, I love that, you know, sometimes you talk about something on the program and it's almost an invitation for people to say, oh yeah, me too. But, you know, that's weird, man. Jared says, a previous boss bought us all voodoo dolls to stick pins in. Of what? Of him or her? That's very, that's almost self-referential. Like, I know I'm a dick, but here's a voodoo doll to make it better. But it's not, I'm not going to stop being a dick. You don't have a voodoo doll of me, Jen. Not that I'm your boss. We work as a team. But I know that sometimes I can be grating. There's no voodoo dolls of me in the office.
Nowhere they can be found.
Super. Great. Okay. Well, I'll give you that. That's crazy. What if you really fancy someone you work with? Symbolic sex doll? Okay, that's made everyone uncomfortable. There would have to be one effigy for each person in the company, and each person gets to see their effigy at the end of the month to see if they've been targeted by anyone or many. Oh, that would be an interesting way to do it. So if everyone had a voodoo doll, and then you just put the voodoo dolls up on, what, some sort of a rack on the company wall, and people see if they've got loads of pins in them, that maybe they need to work on their communication skills within the group. That would be interesting. Although, again, in this particular program, not necessarily something I'd go for. The voodoo-like practice was used up in Ireland to the 1800s, says another. Called buying the sheaf, he used a sheaf of wheat like a human body to stick pins in it. One was found in Louth in 1893. That's from Deborah. Brilliant, Deborah. I did not know that. B. Jones says, don't agree at all with voodoo dolls. Next, stop sticking a knife into the box. Better jot down gripes on paper, absorb them and scratch them off. Much better. They do say that writing down your worries and then, you know, like the old days, it was like, put them in a kettle or tie them to a tree or something. But actually writing down your worries does make, apparently, psychologically, good sense. We're talking about inherited diseases and some of whether or not we should be editing genomes in utero to basically reduce disease. And if you do that, how far do you go? You know, if someone, if we find a gene for like tickly cough, do we edit the embryo of an unborn child to make sure they don't have a tickly cough? One person says, curing heredity problems is easy. Ask those with the condition not to have their own children. It's called evolution. Wow. that's a joke, right? I presume that's a joke. But I'm sure there are people who actually do think that.
There is another word
for
that.
Yeah, it's like eugenics, what?
There is another word for that, yes. Yeah, it's not
eugenics.
Evolution.
Yeah, it's not evolution, it's eugenics. In fact, we are here because of imperfections, right, Jen? We are here because of mutations in the genes of the fathers and forefathers and mothers and foremothers. I've never heard that word before. It sounds weird when I say it out loud. But that's how we have come to where we are. And I think it's a really horrible world to imagine where only people who have so-called perfection exists because everyone else isn't allowed have children or the joy that children bring, although sometimes not always joy. It's a double-edged sword having children, let's be honest.
But I do think that also relies on misunderstanding how genetics works.
Yeah.
Because if you're not aware that you're a carrier for a disease and that so is your partner, the implication is that you've somehow been immoral by having children who have a risk of getting this recessive disease.
Yeah, totally. And then at what stage, if you're someone who carries, for example, CF or Huntington's or something like that, you know, is there then like a dating app for people who have, like, so it just gets wrong. Shane says, loads of texts and tweets. I see producer John sort of sweating because we're about to go into the studio for another piece. So I'll try and get through these quickly. Future proof. Any chance you would get a web developer to take care of your website? Listening on my phone because the site keeps cutting out again every time. Shane, do you know what? I'm going to say it. It's not a popular thing to say, but the way we are doing a podcast is killing me. I don't have that power. If I wielded that power, Shane, I would shape the world, but I don't. Unclean meat. We're talking about meat that doesn't come from an animal and is therefore both environmentally friendly and good for animals. Please discuss insect protein with your guests, says Adrenaline Sports, which is a Twitter account. We've done that many times. Insects are fantastic in almost every way, which is taste and texture. Unfortunately, those seem to be pretty high up on the list of reasons why people will put things in their mouths. I know you say grind it into a thing, like a powder, which Adrenaline Sports sounds like something you would probably do and either snort it or mix it with whey and a whole grey milkshake. But whichever way you have crickets and grasshoppers, and believe me, I've had them quite a few, it's just not very pleasant. Another says, can these clean meats be produced in a way to remove the harmful health effects of eating some meats? Yes, of course. And we did cover that, Miriam, in the podcast. So lactose intolerant milk, you can synthesize that. You can synthesize gluten-free wheat and all this sort of stuff. So yes is the answer to that. Another says, the structure of meat consists of marbling of fat in between muscle tissue and connective material. Do lab-grown meats replicate this? Because if they don't, then burgers are the only type of lab-grown meat we will consume. That's from Ivan. They are working on that. They're working on the fat as well as the meat. And everybody knows that's really, the fat is important, although we hate saying it out loud. Shane and Blessedin says, speak for yourself. Growing up in a farm, I know a lot about where meat comes from and how it's produced. That being said, I would go for this clean meat if it tasted like real meat. Yeah, me too. I think as long as it, you know, I mean, it didn't turn our entire agri-economy up on its head, then I'd be up for it. Jonathan, when will clean meats be on the shelves in Ireland? 5 years, maybe. That's a guess. On facial expressions in apes, we spoke to Ben Garrett, who had a really noisy line, and we were a bit pissed off. But he was at a tour, and he was doing a show, and like sometimes people start walking into your room when you have requested a quiet room. He was in a theatre, and obviously people needed to get around him. And so I'm sorry about the quality for that. You can't say it on the radio because you just hope people don't notice. But he did notice, of course, he did. We spoke to Ben. Ben says, someone says, "Hi guys, did you know that you can train a chimp to park a car without whacking into the ones in front and behind?" From the wise old carpet man. I did not know that. And those chimps would be superior to me in driving ability. I often bump into cars before. That's what bumpers are for, folks. I said it. That's it from us for this week's podcast. Thanks for listening. Have a great St. Patrick's Day. John O'Donovan was producing. Aidan McKelvey was there somewhere in the background. And Jen Largan was both on mic and also researching this week. We'll be back next Saturday with more Future Proof. In the meantime, stay curious.